What if the most important relationship in your life isn't with your partner, your children, or your best friend, but with yourself? When Anita Morjani experienced her near-death experience while battling stage 4 lymphoma, she discovered a profound truth. Self-love wasn't just a nice idea, it was literally life-saving. As her body was shutting down, she realized her cancer stemmed from living without self-love, on others' terms rather than authentically. This revelation not only healed her body, but transformed her understanding of human existence. David Hamilton's I Heart Me has become a touchstone in the self-development world, with celebrities like Oprah and Brené Brown recommending it for its unique blend of scientific rigor and heartfelt vulnerability. Unlike typical self-help books that offer quick fixes, Hamilton's approach acknowledges the genuine struggle of learning to love ourselves in a world that often teaches us we're not enough. Most people live in a state of consciousness that whispers, "I'm not enough," though some pretend otherwise. I spent most of my first 42 years in this deficit state, a cloaked goblin hiding in my mind, ready to sabotage potential good things. The world often reflects back our self-feelings through how people treat us. At school, I was emotionally bullied, culminating in my final year when the in-crowd ran what resembled a campaign against me. They put up mocking posters, declared a sarcastic National We Love Hammy Day, and once tried to throw water on me. When I asked one bully why they treated me this way, his shocked response resonated with my deep-seated belief that I wasn't good enough. Ironically, I was bullied not because I was good at things, but because I constantly told everyone about my achievements, desperately trying to give people reasons to like me, afraid of being shunned. Some eventually reach a transition point of "I've had enough," a passionate, sometimes angry state where they refuse to be taken advantage of anymore. This stage marks the beginning of your self-love journey. Once, while giving a talk to school teachers, I experienced bullying from a biology teacher who aggressively challenged my expertise. Soon, I couldn't speak without someone answering back, my voice constricted, feeling like a child facing stern teachers. Just as I was about to walk away, having had enough, a young Australian student teacher stood up, calling out the schoolyard bullying behavior, triggering applause and causing the ringleader to storm out. This "I've had enough" stage is characterized by passion, sometimes anger, but it's healthy because we recognize our power to control ourselves and shape our reality. It's where decisions are made, relationships change, and we begin to feel free. A lucky few eventually emerge into the peaceful state of "I am enough," characterized by acceptance, laughter, and energy conservation, since they no longer waste effort maintaining facades or seeking approval. Given enough time, many reach this stage where we no longer need to prove our worth. We feel it inside. We don't feel compelled to agree with everyone or need people to like us. We become resilient to shame, unafraid to show our vulnerabilities, and take proper care of ourselves. Life becomes more fluid at this stage, with a sense of contentment and gratitude. We cease resisting life, yet paradoxically gain more influence over it. In many ways, we resemble our child selves, who naturally accept themselves without questioning their worth. Children are born with healthy self-worth, but learn to question it through three main mechanisms. First, they experience shame through identity statements that require impossible changes. When a parent says, "You're so selfish," rather than "That behavior was selfish," the child learns they are fundamentally flawed rather than simply making a mistake. Second, consistent criticism, even well-intentioned, teaches children they're not enough right now. Many high achievers with critical parents become perfectionists, driven by a sense of lack that achievement can never fill. Research shows affluent girls with pushy parents have triple the depression rates of the general population, as they learn to attach self-worth to achievements rather than inherent value. Third, children learn by observing caregivers' behaviors, absorbing their self-worth patterns. If a mother has a self-worth of 7 out of 10 and a father 4, a child who spends more time with the mother will likely develop a similar level. Though exceptions exist, most people carry self-worth settings close to their parents' levels, interpreting the world through that lens and even attracting relationships that maintain familiar emotional patterns. Understanding, rather than blame, must be the path forward when examining parental influence. Most parents genuinely want the best for their children and act according to their own knowledge and limitations. Even when parents make mistakes, they're typically doing what they believe is right, balancing parental responsibilities with other life pressures. Through understanding the roots of our own self-worth issues, we can empower children in our care. Whether as parents, teachers, or extended family, we significantly impact children's self-esteem. If we criticize them, they learn to criticize themselves and others. If we teach acceptance, they learn self-acceptance. If we demonstrate gratitude, they learn appreciation for themselves and others. Emotion isn't just a feeling. It's smeared throughout the body in four interconnected components: the emotion itself, brain chemistry like serotonin and dopamine, the autonomic nervous system affecting skin and organs, and muscles. These components work multidirectionally, meaning changes in any component affect all others. This explains why facial expressions, body posture, and movement patterns can directly influence how we feel. Research by Harvard professor Amy Cuddy shows that adopting power poses for just 2 minutes creates measurable biochemical changes, reducing cortisol by 25% and increasing testosterone by 8%. These high-power postures, where we make our bodies appear bigger, like the Wonder Woman stance, produce confidence and feelings of being enough. Conversely, weak poses that make us smaller increase stress and decrease confidence. Cuddy's research demonstrated that a 2-minute power pose before giving a presentation significantly affects real-world performance. Volunteers who power posed gave higher quality presentations with more fluid communication and less reliance on notes compared to those who adopted weak poses, folded arms, rounded shoulders. The power posers were consistently chosen by judges as the ones they would employ. Additional research from the University of Auckland confirms that upright posture leads to higher self-esteem, positive moods, and lower fear compared to slumped posture, even affecting the language people use during stressful tasks. Our physical posture directly rewires our brain through neuroplasticity. When we consistently stand, walk, and move with confidence, the neural networks associated with "I am enough" strengthen, while the "I'm not enough" networks weaken. The brain doesn't change spontaneously. It changes in response to our repeated behaviors. By consciously adopting postures that embody self-worth, we can transform temporary practice into permanent, effortless habits as our brain physically adapts to this new way of being. Visualization works because our brain cannot distinguish between what's real and what's vividly imagined. By repeatedly visualizing ourselves embodying self-worth, we create the same neural pathways as if we were physically practicing these behaviors. The key to effective visualization is repetition, doing it over and over again. Many people seek a magic bullet in self-help work, hoping for one insight that will effortlessly transform their lives. The real insight is that change requires consistent practice. Just as no one becomes an Olympic champion after a single gym visit, mental practice must be repeated consistently to wire neural networks of "I am enough" until they become automatic. Contrary to outdated beliefs that our brains become hardwired after adolescence, neuroplasticity means our brains remain changeable throughout our entire lives. Research shows that mentally practicing an activity, from playing piano to swinging a golf club, creates nearly identical brain changes as physical practice. Studies reveal that imagining playing piano notes for 5 days creates the same 30 to 40-fold growth in brain regions as actually playing them. However, this principle works both ways. Use it or lose it applies to neural pathways. By consistently practicing self-love and stopping the practice of self-criticism, we can literally forget how to have low self-worth as those neural networks dissolve. Elite athletes understand the power of mental practice. Olympic gold medalist Sally Gunnell attributed 70% of her success to mental preparation, revealing that after hiring a sports psychologist, she extensively visualized running and hurdling daily, a practice that helped her secure Olympic gold after previously failing to win world championships. Importantly, she practiced responding to challenges when someone overtook her or when she felt tired, aspects many people neglect in visualization but which are crucial for success. I experienced this power firsthand when teaching math to troubled 16-year-old boys. After one student's crude dismissal of decimals, I struggled through my first session before ending it 45 minutes early. Devastated, I considered quitting until a colleague challenged me to apply my own self-help teachings. I spent the weekend visualizing myself teaching with confidence, standing tall, speaking clearly, and projecting authority. When I returned, though still afraid, I handled the class better. By sharing my scientific background and making deals for 20 minutes of mad shit, fascinating topics like quantum physics, in exchange for attention during math lessons, I transformed the class. Every student eventually earned an A, with one tough boy moved to tears upon seeing his grade, having assumed he wasn't good enough. While speaking in Las Vegas, despite receiving overwhelmingly positive reception, with one audience member laughing so hard he fell off his chair, I became fixated on a single stern-faced man who appeared unimpressed. This one person's apparent disapproval consumed my thoughts, even while others praised my presentation. This experience illustrates our natural human tendency to focus on potential rejection rather than acceptance. While it's often said we shouldn't worry about others' opinions of us, I suggest a more balanced approach. It's normal and even healthy to care what others think. It shows awareness of our social impact. But we shouldn't be controlled by these concerns. The key is maintaining awareness without adopting others' opinions as our own unless they genuinely resonate. I challenge the common claim that some people don't care what others think, suggesting this statement usually masks insecurity, serves as a coping mechanism, or functions as an affirmation rather than reality. Our desire for social acceptance is biologically wired. Historically, rejection meant potential death through isolation from the group. Though modern survival rarely depends on social acceptance, this deep evolutionary programming remains embedded in our psyche. Social connection even acts as a longevity support, with studies showing increased happiness correlating with greater connectedness. Connection produces oxytocin, a cardioprotective hormone that's been essential to human evolution for approximately 500 million years. Though we're biologically wired to seek acceptance, compromising our authenticity to be liked ultimately weakens our connections. People often change their appearance or behavior to gain acceptance, even saying things they don't believe in professional settings. While adapting out of sensitivity is acceptable, doing so out of fear signals we're not enough. Paradoxically, the more authentic we are, the stronger our connections become, and the more deeply we wire "I am enough" into our neural pathways. Though authenticity risks rejection, it creates space for relationships based on our true selves rather than our pretenses. Shame keeps us stuck in the "not enough" mindset by confusing our behavior with our identity. It operates by making everything personal through "I am" statements. Instead of saying, "I did something stupid," shame says, "I am stupid." We can separate circumstances from identity by extracting the "I am" from shame statements. Through a 5-part exercise, we can reframe shame statements by acknowledging what happened without defining ourselves by it, and then affirming a positive truth about ourselves instead. This mental distinction builds resilience against shame by recognizing that behaviors and conditions aren't the same as identity. To develop shame resilience, we can follow 4 steps. First, diffuse stress through the insight that everyone experiences shame. Second, extract the "I am" as previously described. Third, use physical movement to shift brain resources from stress areas to positive areas, literally dancing the shame away. Fourth, reach out to others, as connection helps us realize we are enough. These steps work by redirecting brain resources from survival areas toward empathy and higher-order thinking. Perfectionism often fuels shame, defined as the tendency to set excessively high standards, rigidly adhere to them, and engage in overly critical self-evaluations. While healthy perfectionism involves striving for excellence, unhealthy perfectionism stems from the belief that if I'm not perfect, I won't be accepted. This creates a perpetual "I'll be enough when" mindset that pushes enough further away. Perfectionists become hypersensitive to others' opinions and withhold their creations until they're perfect, really saying, "I need to be better before I can show myself." This prevents connection and shrinks their sense of self-worth. A powerful affirmation to counter this is, "I am not my accomplishments and creations. Regardless of whether I win or lose, succeed or fail, the truth always remains that I am enough." Body image is the number one major shamer, with most people feeling insecure about at least one aspect of their appearance. Studies show that 87% of women have dieted, usually to increase self-confidence and self-esteem. Body image shame plays a significant role in eating disorders, with research showing higher levels of shame in those with eating disorders even after recovery. Men also face body image pressures, though it's less discussed. Male models in advertisements are increasingly muscular, and studies show that between the 1970s and 2000, the average Playgirl centerfold gained 12 kilograms of muscle while losing 5 kilograms of fat. In response to these unrealistic standards, approximately 60,000 people in the UK inject themselves with steroids annually, with many teenage boys feeling inadequate and puny when comparing themselves to idealized male bodies in media. Dieting from a place of feeling not enough is counterproductive. When weight loss is motivated by lack of self-love, even successful diets often fail long-term because the underlying belief of inadequacy remains. The acceptance paradox suggests that complete self-acceptance actually produces spontaneous, healthy change rather than complacency. The key difference is that changes originate from a state of feeling enough rather than not enough, making them more sustainable. To improve body image, we can follow four practical steps. First, decide to learn to like yourself as you are, which gives direction without requiring immediate change. Second, understand that opinions about attractiveness are subjective and constantly changing throughout history, from plump being ideal to waif-like models. Third, allow yourself to be authentic rather than conforming. Fourth, focus on three body parts you like and give them consistent attention. These exercises work like physical training. Consistency brings the biggest breakthroughs. True vulnerability requires authenticity and honesty, not merely opening up for attention. Being vulnerable means letting your guard down, showing who you really are regardless of acceptance, and having the courage to say, "I am enough." Vulnerability manifests when we create something and share it with the world, have difficult conversations, initiate intimacy, love completely, ask for what we need, or admit our fears and sadness. I experienced this when my dog Oscar was diagnosed with bone cancer with only months to live. This trauma transformed my partner Elizabeth, who had always been extremely private and guarded. For the first time, she cried openly in front of people she barely knew, allowing them to care and creating connections through vulnerability. Similarly, I cried in front of my parents, leading to a deeper relationship with my father, who showed support in his own way. These experiences demonstrated how vulnerability, even when forced by circumstances, invites others to care and be human, creating magical connections. The risks of vulnerability include rejection, distance from social groups, lost relationships, and criticism. But the benefits far outweigh these. Releasing the stress of pretending, relaxing in private moments, gaining genuine respect, making room for authentic relationships, forming deeper connections, and improving health. Being authentic doesn't mean becoming completely open with everyone. Finding the right balance of vulnerability works differently for each individual. Making empowered choices about when and with whom to be vulnerable demonstrates being enough more than indiscriminate openness. We're naturally drawn to authenticity. Babies and puppies have it in abundance. I call this the law of personal gravity. The more authentic we are, the more people are drawn to us. As we grow up, our light diminishes under layers of beliefs that convince us we're not enough. Authenticity, vulnerability, honesty, and self-care increase our gravity, while feeling not enough weakens it. This isn't about quantity of connections, but quality. High personal gravity attracts deeper relationships. Like Dobby the house elf who punishes himself in Harry Potter, many of us inflict pain on ourselves, not by bashing our heads, but with harsh words. If self-criticism were an Olympic sport, the competition would be fierce. Despite childhood sayings like sticks and stones may break my bones, words do hurt, especially when we use them against ourselves. I'm such an idiot. I'm a failure. I'm so fat and ugly. These self-attacks happen far more frequently than criticism from others, creating a constant stream of internal negativity that undermines our well-being. Would you criticize a child for falling while learning to walk? Probably not. Yet we often deny ourselves the same grace. We're all like children stumbling through life, making mistakes because we're human. Self-compassion acknowledges this reality and gently says, "It's okay." It's the antidote to self-criticism, taking action to relieve pain through kind thoughts, soothing activities, or simple comforts. Self-compassion acts as a triple anti-inflammatory, reducing biological inflammation, self-criticism, and relationship inflammation. Studies show people with more self-compassion have lower levels of stress-induced inflammation in their bloodstream, protecting against diseases like cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes. A 6-week compassion training program demonstrated that those practicing self-compassion techniques showed significantly lower inflammation levels when stressed compared to control groups. The loving-kindness meditation helps heal difficult relationships by replacing hostility with gentleness. While some might want to hold on to anger toward others who've wronged them, such hostility damages our own health. Studies show it contributes to arterial hardening as much as poor diet does. Research dubbed Hard Marriage, Hard Heart found couples displaying hostility and aggression had higher levels of coronary artery calcification than those showing love and compassion. The vagus nerve, our longest cranial nerve, is the star player in how compassion reduces inflammation. People with high vagal tone maintain lower inflammation levels. The vagus nerve controls inflammation by sending signals directly to immune cells and DNA, telling inflammatory genes to switch off. This explains why loving-kindness meditation can reduce chronic pain. It literally turns down inflammation at the genetic level. Forgiveness removes a major obstacle to self-love. Many people struggle with the question, "How can I love myself when I did that?" Self-forgiveness involves reflecting on the health benefits of forgiveness, examining whether self-judgment serves any purpose, creating positive affirmations, practicing self-compassion, considering what your inner wisdom would say, and making amends when appropriate. A simple but powerful approach is asking, "What was my intention?" to recognize that beneath hurtful actions often lies fear, and beneath fear lies love. We rarely truly intend to hurt others, which is why we feel regret afterward. Forgiving others naturally emerges from self-love, though some resist it because they don't want to let others off the hook. Forgiveness isn't about condoning unacceptable behavior, but choosing to release the past to move forward. Both self-forgiveness and forgiving others dissolve barriers to growth and pave the way to self-love. Self-care demonstrates I am enough, while allowing life to fall into ruin signals not enough. Taking control of your life involves clearing clutter to create a nourishing environment, gaining control over finances, finding meaning and purpose, learning to say no, straightening out relationships through necessary conversations, tackling postponed tasks, and improving health through exercise and better dietary habits. While being compassionate toward others is admirable, people can be more effective when they have more energy, which comes from living from "I am enough." Self-love isn't selfish, but rather like an internal bar of soap that cleans our heart and mind, creating space for more authentic and effective compassion toward others. Taking action is a crucial part of self-love, consistently behaving in ways that demonstrate "I am enough." This often requires pushing beyond your comfort zone, which is where the biggest gains in self-worth typically happen. Even when afraid, taking action comes before feeling better about yourself. Everyone experiences fear, even those who appear confident. Many wait for perfect readiness, enough books, seminars, or magical insights before taking action, but this approach is misguided. Overcoming fear happens through stepping out into the world and showing ourselves authentically. Consistent action, repetition, is what wires in a sense of being enough. Our bodies are 99.999999999999% empty space, atoms composed of subatomic particles emerging from the quantum field of pure energy. This raises profound questions about where consciousness resides. Near-death experiences like Anita Morjani's, where she experienced consciousness detached from her body, expanding to become the entire universe, suggest consciousness may extend beyond our physical form. Studies by cardiologist Pim Van Lommel found 18% of cardiac arrest survivors reported NDEs that can't be easily dismissed as hallucinations. The brain may be more like a television that receives rather than creates consciousness. Just as TV damage affects signal quality without creating the content, brain damage affects consciousness without necessarily producing it. Experiments showing neural correlations between physically separated people suggest consciousness extends beyond individual brains, with people correctly identifying callers at rates significantly above chance. The attractive forces holding atoms together represent a fundamental law of attraction without which the universe couldn't exist. If consciousness is infinite and permeates everything, including these attractive forces, then we are essentially made of love, with our atoms representing large expressions of this fundamental force. The fundamental truth is that we are enough. We've never been not enough and never will be. Just as a poster might read, "I am beautiful," because the correct ending is simply "I am," which is also the beginning. We are all worthy of love, health, happiness, wealth, and life's joys. This isn't an empty slogan, but a fact. Rather than making excuses or seeking approval, we can embrace our inherent worthiness. When we discover our real self, the right people will find us too. Authenticity creates gravity that draws others to us, while children and puppies naturally have this quality in abundance. The goal isn't to have gravity, it's to be authentic and know we're enough. Gravity is simply an indicator of our progress.